Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. David Crowley is back in the governor's race with just weeks to go before primary day. And Wisconsin's Office of Lawyer Regulation is moving to suspend former Milwaukee Judge Hannah Dugan's law license. Plus, a lawsuit challenges Elections Commission guidance about spoiling ballots. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for July 24th. I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm Scott Bauer.
Welcome to Rewind. Before we kind of jump into the politics news of the week, we obviously want to acknowledge what took place 12 blocks from where we are taping right now, this police-involved shooting a couple of days ago, ongoing protests and a vigil there. We will be talking about that a little bit later in the show and sort of some of the political implications and conversations around that. But it felt strange to jump into, you know, the news of David Crowley, which was kind of how we were going to lead the show, without naming that that's been going on. So we will come back to that. But let's start with this news that started last Saturday, and we kind of knew it was coming, which is that David Crowley, who had dropped out of the race for governor, is now back in. Let's start with a little bit of video from his announcement on Saturday.
Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is David Crowley. I am the county executive of Milwaukee County, and I am running to be the next governor of the great state of Wisconsin. The governor's endorsement reflects his confidence that I have the experience, that I have the judgment and the record to build the type of coalition that we need to defeat Tom Tiffany and lead effectively from the very first day in office. This race is not just about who can win the primary, y'all. This is about winning in November. Republicans are spending millions right now to prop up candidates they believe that they can beat. They've made their choice. Now it's time for Democrats. We need to make our choice.
So truly one of the most kind of topsy-turvy weeks that we've had in politics, certainly that I've covered. Mm-hmm. So let's start by talking sort of what's going well for Crowley in campaign 2.0. He got the Evers endorsement, mm-hmm. Which for many months, you know, Tony Evers said he wasn't most likely going to endorse, but he sort of reserved the right to. Part of what was, you know, kind of known to us going into that announcement is that Evers had decided to make that endorsement. And then since then, Crowley has announced that he's raised over $550,000 just in the less than a week that he's been back in, and he's launched a six-figure ad buy. So again, before we get into some of the other stuff that's come up about his campaign this week, what does that tell us about his second stab at this?
Yeah, so I mean, the governor endorsing is a huge thing, right? Like, I don't believe he's ever endorsed in a primary before. I think he'd been pretty clear that he wasn't going to endorse, and then out of the blue, he endorses. You've got an effort by some Democrats to get, you know, behind Crowley and get him to be the alternative to Hong, to be the more mainstream Democratic candidate in the race. Three other candidates, four if you count Hong, obviously making arguments contrary to that. So we'll see where voters land on it. We'll talk a little bit later about where the electorate is on that Marquette poll. But you do get the sense, anecdotally talking with people, that they're undecided. I just came here from a Mark Pocan news conference where Mark Pocan said he's undecided. He's going to decide a couple, 3 days before the primary. So I think he and a lot of Democrats in the state are just kind of like trying to figure out where to go. And for a lot of them, the number one question is, who's the most electable in November? And David Crowley, as you heard in that clip, is making that argument that he is the one to coalesce around, that he's the one who's best suited to beat Tom Tiffany in November. And we'll see what happens over the next couple weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been sort of a lot of the back and forth that we've heard, again, around this question of electability. And one thing that I heard from people who were disappointed when he dropped out, from his sort of core supporters, was that there was always a question of his electability as a man of color coming from Milwaukee, that those are sort of two things that have not kind of elevated past people to statewide office. And then now he's being trotted out as the establishment figure. And I heard from one of his supporters, you know, which one is it? Is he unelectable for this reason, or is he too establishment? And I think that's kind of this interesting I talk about the sort of 3D chess that Democratic voters often try to play, where it's not just what candidate do I prefer, but which candidate can win, who are my neighbors going to vote for, who is my uncle up north going to vote for,
right.
And rather than necessarily kind of going behind a candidate that they prefer. But you're right, David Crowley is now making this argument, well, Republicans are putting their thumb on the scale by backing Hong, by putting all of this money towards elevating her, because they think that they can beat her in November, so I am the person who can both satisfy Democratic voters and bring more people into the fold.
Right, and the other thing to remember is there are a large number of Democratic voters who are angry. They're angry not only at Donald Trump and Republicans and the whole MAGA movement, they're angry at Democrats and Democratic leadership in Congress and Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries and all these people. There's a lot of anger coming from Democrats, and those folks are looking for someone who can channel that anger, and a lot of them are going toward Hong. But the ones who are also very angry at Republicans say, I'm angry at Democrats, but I also want to win. And I think there are other candidates who might be better, have a better chance, as we'll see in the Marquette poll and the head-to-head with Tiffany. Other Democrats will say, look, this is a primary. We're not in the general election yet. The party in power, the Republicans in this election, are going to have a very hard time. No matter who the Democratic nominee is going to be, they're going to get attacked. It's going to be a very negative campaign. But we have a lot of things going in our favor in the midterm that we will be able to use against Tom Tiffany, no matter who the nominee is. So, very unsettled as we sit here 2.5 weeks or whatever it is out from the primary.
Right. And I mean, to that point, you know, as he tries to reestablish himself and make the case that even though he said 2 weeks ago he didn't have a path and he didn't have the money, that now he does have that path and he does have that money, other stuff is starting to come to light. So one of them is this Twitter feed from about 15 years ago. Dirt McGurk, I believe, was the handle on it. And it just had a number of sexist, homophobic, really kind of juvenile jokes on there. He is linked to it, but he said he ran it with a number of his friends. He did not author that. I asked him about the Twitter feed, and he said, you know, it tells you that I associated with some knuckleheads in my 20s. But that's, you know, the kind of opposition research that sort of starts to come forward when you are running a credible campaign. And then the other thing that's come forward this week is a complaint was filed with the Ethics Commission about his campaign finance. So it says that he inappropriately transferred over $142,000 from his county executive campaign over to his gubernatorial campaign. His spokesperson says that the allegations are largely meritless. They're still reviewing them, but that they followed kind of legal guidance about how that money is and is not allowed to be moved around. But again, like, what does that tell you, that all of this stuff in 2.0 is coming up
right.
That wasn't there?
Well, I think you said it already, and it kind of just went over very quickly, but it shows that it's a credible campaign, right? I mean, these Oppo books, the Dirt McGurk thing, that was known, I am sure, for a long time. And so they're waiting for when they feel like is the most opportune time to use it. And him getting the Evers endorsement, getting all that money, now's the time, the opponents would say, to put something like that out to kind of deflate the campaign as best they can. So that says to me that the opposition is viewing him as a credible candidate, as they should, with that money coming in and with the Evers thing. And for sure, we're going to start to see ads with Evers in them. Again, to kind of foreshadow the Marquette poll, Tony Evers has been and continues to be the most popular Democratic politician in the state, and I think the most popular politician of either party in the state. So if you're Crowley, you're looking at that and you're saying, well, who can I attach myself to that would give me the biggest chance at some kind of a boost? And that's what he's doing. The downside of that, again, are these Democrats I referenced before who are kind of sick of the party establishment and want somebody to challenge that more directly. Those folks are not going to be going to Crowley. They're going to be going to somebody like Hong.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, one of the ways that he has kind of positioned himself was that he would certainly get Milwaukee. He could make really big inroads in the suburbs, and then he could hold the line on rural areas so that he can kind of reach a broad swath of Wisconsin, as opposed to more of like a barn-burning progressive campaign that's being run by the other frontrunners.
But Mandela Barnes would have something to say about, I will take Milwaukee, because he is also from Milwaukee. He's run statewide before. He has very high name recognition. So there is a potential that those two split a lot of the Milwaukee vote, which makes it that much easier for Hong to win the primary.
Yeah, and so let's get into the Marquette poll that we were talking about. And obviously the huge, huge caveat that we have to attach to this is that Sarah Rodriguez was still in the race at the time that they ran this poll. David Crowley was not in the race. And so the outcome for if they were to take the 11% that Sarah Rodriguez got and then split it among everybody's second choice, puts Hung clearly in the lead, then Barnes, Brennan, and then Brennan and Roy's, you know, in the single digit still. So the big question is, what would new results say for Crowley? And then what should we make of the 48% of Democratic voters who are still undecided?
I think there are a lot of caveats with this poll, and you raised some of them. And I won't go into all the details, but I think it needs to be taken with a huge grain of salt about what this really tells us about the race. And Marquette even acknowledged it, because they're going to run a whole new poll next week focused on the governor's race with all these different movements and everything. But if you want to just focus on the undecided, to go back to my earlier point about Mark Pocan and a lot of Democrats, I think that's probably fairly accurate. You know, a lot of people are waiting to the very end to kind of see who emerges from this field, who they feel like meets what they're looking for. And that said, you know, I think it is fair to say that Hong, in virtually every poll that has been made public, Marquette and these internal polls, which don't pass any kind of like scientific, you know, evaluation because you can't see the questions they're asking, but they've all shown her in the lead. The numbers have varied. So I think it's, and based on everything we've seen in the campaign, I think it's fairly, you know, widely acknowledged that she is the leading candidate, with that asterisk of 50% are undecided. So that leaves this thing very much up in the air, and that's why I think Crowley is getting back in, and Evers feels like he can get behind him because there's room for somebody to make a move.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that these polls also show is who has the most kind of excited voters, and so that's clearly Hong and to a lesser extent Barnes. But then you have the 48% of voters who are perhaps not excited voters, but they will vote, and so they're not necessarily going to be an impassioned base that's going to stand out in a rainstorm for you for four hours to cast a ballot, but they will show up and cast a ballot. And so if that's half of Democratic voters, then even, you know, Brennan and Roy's with their 2% and 5% respectively could chip away at that and end up with some people who show up day of, kind of make a decision on the fly.
Yeah.
So there's lots for us to be continuing to watch for. A couple other updates on the race here. We saw, I think, one of the most negative ads come out so far, which was Joel Brennan's, again, to this question of electability, arguing that he is the most electable. And he starts out, you know, with a photo of Fran Hong, and he calls her a socialist. And then he points out that Mandela Barnes has lost for statewide. And then what the heck has Crowley been up to? Mm-hmm. And really kind of very pointed, and then does not mention Calderoy's at all. And so it's been kind of one of the most negative ads. It was received also by some Democratic voters as potentially racist because he calls out the three candidates of color. And then the other kind of notable update, I think, this week is that Tom Tiffany appeared on a podcast with a man who, among other things, wore a Camp Auschwitz t-shirt to a rally. If not to January 6th, I'm getting my details somewhat confused. But anyways, it brings up again this question of, like with the Twitter feed, like with Fran Hong going on Hassan Piker's stream, what does it tell us when they are sort of the people that these candidates kind of align themselves with or at least stand next to, what does that tell us about their values?
Right. I mean, it tells us that, you know, everything, the candidates are trying to get their message out to everyone they think they want to have hear it, right? And they seem, at least a couple of the candidates seem very indiscriminate about who they're going to go talk to, and they open themselves up to this criticism. But when we get past August 11th, the amount of negative ads we're going to see and on both sides is going to be through the roof. Because no matter who the nominees are, they both are going to have plenty of stuff to mine. And the two things that you pick here are at the very, you know, the bare minimum of what we're going to see. So it's going to be people who are sick of campaign ads, like, hold on to your hat, because we haven't seen anything yet.
Sorry. And, you know, and it might be sort of reminiscent also of 2018, when Republicans were the ones who kind of came out bruised from a very divided primary. Will that again happen with Democrats? I think one thing, so we'll transfer now to talking about the police shooting. And one of the kind of political aspects of that is how the different candidates have responded. And so I'm just going to quickly run through. The Democrats are fairly aligned in their message, and then Tom Tiffany in his. So Roy's called for a full independent investigation. Brennan called for a full, transparent, and independent accounting of what happened. Barnes, independent and transparent. Crowley, thorough, transparent, and independent investigation. So kind of similar there. The big difference among Democrats is that Hong went to the spot where it took place, spoke into a megaphone, called it an execution, called for the preservation of body camera footage, which actually does not exist in Madison. We'll talk about that in a moment. Compared that to Tom Tiffany's reaction, we should allow the process to establish the facts without politicians rushing to judgment or stoking division. But he did then say that he helped pass the state law about that requires independent investigations into police-involved deaths. So you've been covering this really extensively. What do you make of, again, the sort of political reaction?
I think of all the people you just mentioned, the Hong reaction stands out the most, right? She was the only one who's physically down there the night that it happened, talking to the people. She lives not far from where the shooting was. Her campaign office is right around the corner. She's very familiar with that neighborhood. It's less than 2 miles from where we are right now. And it's the site of two other previous police shootings in the past 10 or 15 years, you know, within blocks of one another. So there's a lot going on there. But the fact that Hong made an appearance and then said what she said really separates her, for good or bad, however you look at it, but it does separate her from the field of how other people were responding. And her comment about being a state-sponsored execution, if she is the nominee, you will see that repeated extensively throughout the campaign.
Yeah, I've already seen, for example, Eric Toney, who's running for Attorney General, clip that on his social media and talk about how that's, again, sort of stoking division, you know, fanning the flames of an already very emotional situation. And so I think you're exactly right that this is a moment, a little bit of a watershed moment potentially in this campaign. I also want to talk a little bit about, you know, sort of how voters might be looking towards their leaders in a moment like this. I happened to be interviewing David Crowley for a separate reason the day after, and so of course I asked him about it, and I said, you know, what should a governor, how should a governor respond in a moment like this? And he essentially said, you know, by unifying. But what actually, I think, do people want from elected leaders when they're facing this kind of community tragedy?
It's a good question, and I think it obviously varies depending on the voter and what they're looking for, right? I think a lot of people would say they're looking for calm, and they're looking for law enforcement to, you know, establish that calm. But there are also people who are very angry about how law enforcement operates, and they want answers. And this is an ongoing conversation that we've seen nationally, you know, and it's been very prominent since George Floyd. And, you know, again, it's happened in Madison before. And so it's a continued moment of reckoning that kind of goes through all levels of society, from the people in office through your police departments down to the folks who, you know, are angry and protesting. And so it gets into everyone's lives in some way, shape, or form, and it has political ramifications, it has personal ramifications, it leads to events around Madison that you like to go to that are canceled because of different things that are going on. So it's just one of those things that kind of, you know, transcends in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, we were also talking before we taped about how people often also go straight to their camps of either, you know, every police shooting is justified or no police shooting is justified. And it becomes this kind of, you know, impenetrable divide in some ways. But it's interesting also to see how Madison specifically is dealing with it. Obviously, a hugely liberal city, state capital, lots of students, this kind of thing. And so, for example, I think that played out with the press conference that you attended yesterday, where, among other things, the protesters took over the podium, held signs calling for the killing of cops, or at least saying that that wouldn't be such a bad thing. That's the kind of thing that maybe could happen in that conversation in Madison, in a way that if this took place in a different political jurisdiction, it would not have played out necessarily that way.
Yeah, I mean, temperatures, fever is running high right now. And I think people in power, as you saw at that news conference, are trying to tamp things down as best they can without being dismissive of what people are saying that they're hearing that frustration, they're hearing that anger, and that was expressed in the officials letting that happen yesterday. It didn't seem like the protesters were satisfied with anything they heard at the news conference, and more actions are planned over the weekend. So this is not something, and we're awaiting, you know, these investigations that are going on and potentially criminal charges or not. You know, all of these markers that we've seen in every other shooting can be another point where things go sideways, one way or the other. So there's more to come on this, and it will be a political issue going into the fall.
Yeah, and at a local level, you know, we talked about the body camera issue, and that's been a big source of debate here in Madison. And so that'll also be interesting just, again, at the city level to see what leaders do with that. There were also a number of lawsuits filed this week relating to how we're going to vote in the next couple of weeks. And so I'll go through them fairly quickly. The kind of major one is that with all the back and forth of who's in and who's out of the race, as of this morning, 90,000 absentee ballots have been submitted, some of which presumably are for Sarah Rodriguez or Missy Hughes or are not for David Crowley when he's now back in. And so WEC issued new guidance on July 9th. I'm sorry, adopted it on July 10th, saying that you can only spoil your ballot, you can only kind of recast a ballot if there was a mistake, and that changing your mind doesn't count as a mistake. And so yesterday, a group of Democratic voters filed a lawsuit saying that that's not fair, that disenfranchises voters, and there's going to be a hearing next Tuesday in this case because it obviously has huge ramifications for an election that's in 2.5 weeks.
Yeah, big day on Tuesday. You have a hearing in this lawsuit where they're seeking an injunction to require WEC to withdraw that guidance. That's on Tuesday afternoon. Tuesday morning, early in-person absentee voting begins around the state. So you can go into your, you know, various polling places. Not every polling place. Check your local listings. But many, you can go cast your ballot in person. That starts on Tuesday. And then Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, we have the Democratic gubernatorial debate in Milwaukee. So you'll have a lot to talk about a week from today on Rewind. So tune in. But yes, I mean, that lawsuit is, it's got to move pretty quick, right? Mm-hmm. Because Tuesday is, what, the 28th, and so you're 2 weeks out on Tuesday from the election. Yeah. So I would think that judge on Tuesday is not going to take very long to do whatever he's going to do.
Right, and the argument is that it violates both federal and state rules, that you can't change the rules for absentee voting in the middle. And so this could potentially, you know, go to the Supreme Court relatively quickly. There was also a lawsuit filed yesterday as well on behalf of the League of Women Voters.
Today.
Was it filed today?
Today.
Oh, well, I got a heads up yesterday.
Well, there you go.
That would allow, or asking a judge to let voters cast provisional ballots if they are worried that their mailed-in absentee ballots are not going to make it in time. Mm-hmm. What's of note in this lawsuit?
Well, for people who don't know, if you submit an absentee ballot, you can go on the website, kind of like with your post office tracking number, and see, is my ballot in yet? Is my ballot in yet? And it'll show you kind of where it is in the process. So the theory here is if it's election day and you're clicking on the website and your ballot has not been received yet, you could reasonably worry that your ballot is not going to get there in time because of postal service issues or whatever. And this would say you could go in and cast a provisional ballot, which would then be held back. And if your absentee ballot makes it in on election day, your provisional ballot is destroyed. If your absentee ballot doesn't make it in, then they count the provisional ballot. So yet another wrinkle, yet another brand new lawsuit, and you know we'll see where this one goes.
Yeah, always a complicated conversation.
Always a lawsuit,
that's right.
Right.
One thing that hasn't received a lawsuit yet is a final piece of WEC guidance that says don't bet on your vote. So essentially you can't place a bet on the outcome of an election that you were casting a vote in. But interestingly, Polymarket and Kelshi, which are prediction markets, are pushing back on this. First of all, because they say that they allow people to place to sell futures contracts, so they are a financial market, not a gambling platform, and they're trades, not bets. And so they're essentially saying that this is discrimination against Wisconsinites who use those platforms maybe to vote or to bet or trade on basketball results or whatever, that this could potentially disenfranchise those voters. So that will be really interesting as we kind of enter into this new normal where...
You can bet on it.
You can bet on it. There you go. Lots of puns to come. Also this week, the Office of Lawyer Regulation is looking into suspending Hannah Dugan's law license. So this is kind of the latest disciplinary action against her. She obviously stepped down as judge, but this is what is described as sort of a routine approach if somebody is convicted of a, quote, serious crime, which includes a felony, as she was. She can respond in the next 20 days. This comes 2 weeks, I believe, after she was fined $5,000 but sentenced to no jail time in the case of letting this person out of her courtroom. And meanwhile, the case is also being appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So this has just been this like ongoing and again maybe precedent setting or at least kind of sending a message about how the Trump administration in particular is going to go after lawyers as they deal with ICE and immigration. And that also brings us actually to another hearing this week in an immigration matter. So this is Salah Sarsour, the leader of Wisconsin's largest mosque, the Islamic Society of Milwaukee. He was detained in March, held in prison in Indiana, released last month over health concerns. So there's both a federal case going on there, but this was his immigration hearing. The first one took place in Chicago. It was an all-day hearing on Tuesday, I believe it was, Wednesday, a day that I sat in and watched it. And essentially his team is making the argument that he is being targeted on the basis of pro-Palestinian speech, that this is a First Amendment issue. The government argues that he did not share details of a criminal conviction that he received in Israel or in Israeli courts when he was growing up in Ramallah. His team says that the government did know about it, and again, that they're just bringing this up now. And so, again, I think that this could potentially be precedent setting. It's somewhat similar to the case of the Columbia University student who similarly was really kind of targeted for action based on protest activities. And so that's a really interesting thing to watch. There's another hearing this coming Tuesday. Yes, it was Tuesday. And then potentially a third one as they decide whether he committed a deportable offense. So that is it for Rewind this week. Lots to continue paying attention to. And we will see you next week. I am Uneven Wagtendonk.
And I'm Scott Bauer.
Take care.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.